This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Wherever you're from, there's probably a local specialty that just tastes like home and some little place down the road that makes it better than anywhere else in the world. Some of these dishes can only be had in season. Others are available year-round, but they're not special because they're served on a white tablecloth. Some of the best food arrives in a plain old brown paper bag. Calvin Trillin loves those kinds of places, and he'll gladly travel to the ends of the earth to find the cafe that knows how to fry a piece of marlin or prepare a bowl of ceviche. His new book, Feeding a Yen, is the latest in a series of collections about traveling to eat and the rapture of great food. Calvin Trillin is our main guest this hour. If there's a truly spectacular local dish where you come from, we'd love to hear about it. You can email us at totn@npr.org, or you can call and tell us about the best dish you've ever had. The phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Later in the program, we'll talk about the biggest military operation in Iraq since the fall of Saddam, and we'll go to Presque Isle, Maine, for a live conversation from Saturn. But first, Calvin Trillin joins us from our bureau in New York. His new book is Feeding a Yen, Savoring Local Specialties from Kansas City to Cusco. And Calvin Trillin, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much, Neil.
You begin one of the chapters in your book. If I'm so intent on eating the local specialty wherever I happen to be, how exactly did I find myself in the market for a Chinese restaurant in Paris? The answer you write is complicated, but I'm pretty sure its origins are buried somewhere in a visit I made in the late 60s to the Republic of Nauru. To the Republic of Nauru?
Oh, yeah. The Republic of Nauru is an island in the Central Pacific that is made out of phosphate and is actually more valuable as a mineral than it is as a republic. So I was there to watch people see their beloved homeland get carted away in large ships while they got rich. And it seems like a very forbidding place to try to grow anything. It has a shelf reef rather than a barrier reef, which makes it very difficult to have boats around there, and no place to grow anything. It's just a little island with some sand and where you take phosphate away, it looks usually compared to the other side of the moon, like these gnarled coral pinnacles. And there were Chinese contract workers there, and somehow there was a restaurant there, a Chinese restaurant called Star Twinkles. Somehow they had fresh vegetables, somehow they had fresh fish, and it was marvelous. And I think it instilled in me, this was about 35 years ago, an almost religious belief in the power of the overseas Chinese to have a good restaurant anywhere. Even Paris.
Right. We can make arguments about Belfast, but anyway, but that's how you weren't a food writer to begin with. You were going on stories to write about things like the enrichment of the people of Nauru.
Oh yeah, that's right. I mean, I wasn't not only wasn't I a food writer to begin with, but I for a long time I didn't write about it at all. I've sort of crept back to it in the last couple of years. I think it was partly because I did a series of pieces around the country for The New Yorker every 3 weeks. I was in a strange town, and I was sort of desperate to get something to eat. And this began in 1967, and I think if you had asked a group of well-informed, educated, sophisticated Americans in 1967 to name a chef, they would have been unable to. I mean, it wasn't a big food time. And the 1965 Immigration Act, which I think food people think of as their very own Emancipation Proclamation, hadn't come into it. It had been passed, but it hadn't really, the effects hadn't kicked in. As you probably know, before 1965, from the 20s, our immigration system was based on national quotas that favored people from Great Britain and Northern Europe. It was based on the theory, I think, that people who eat bland food make better citizens than other people, which I think is not true. And they actually were taking in more people from England than wanted to come and excluding Chinese. So in culinary terms, that's sort of suicidal.
Nobody's ever compared mushy peas to Sichuan.
No, that's true. And if you go, for instance, if you go now, say, to Queens in New York, the borough of Queens, Roosevelt Avenue, and you see one restaurant with Filipino barbecue and the next restaurant with Tibetan momo and the next restaurant with Salvadoran pupusas, you have to realize that if we hadn't changed the immigration laws, each one of those restaurants would have specialties like mushy peas, bubble and squeak, old gray meat, overcooked vegetables. So it's been quite an improvement.
Now, at the beginning of the program, we played a clip of tape about your technique for interrogating hotel clerks to tell you the best place in town. You know, you said, I want to know the place you came back to after 5 years in Korea, and that's usually a pretty good place. And I must say, I've tried similar techniques, and, you know, I usually find after I go to those places that, you know, just after I've ordered, the waiter turns around and you see the can opener in his back pocket, which is never a good sign.
No, well, that's possible, although a friend of mine who cooks, who's lived all of his life in New Iberia, Louisiana, and is a fine cook of Cajun food, took the trouble to find the very best etouffee, crawfish etouffee recipe in New Iberia. I thought his was just fine as it was, but he was like one of those research and development people who's never quite satisfied, and he got it from an architect who everybody agreed had the best etouffee, thinking that maybe the secret ingredient would be some herb you could only find in certain times of year on the banks of the Chafalaya Basin spillway. And it turned out the secret ingredient was Campbell's cream of mushroom soup. So after that, when he came to New York and made etouffee, he would say at one point, I think this would be a good time for certain sensitive people to leave the kitchen for just a little while. Then you'd hear the whine of the can opener and a kind of a glub, glub, glub. But there was a time in the 50s, I think, which is when crawfish etouffee was invented. It's not an old dish. That people thought practically any recipe was improved by a can of Campbell's cream of mushroom soup.
Hey, a little taste of Camden, New Jersey never hurt anything.
No, that, and the Soup Tureen Museum, don't forget that.
Let's take some phone calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And call and tell me, and more importantly, Calvin Trillin, about the fabulous local delicacy wherever it is that you're from. And let's go to Mick, who joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil. Great show. I love listening to it all the time.
Thank you.
I am from a small town in Indiana called Chesterton, Indiana, and it's a little one-stoplight place. And I now live in Portland, Oregon, and I miss my favorite little gyro spot. It's like a little mom-and-pop roadside stand, but they make the best gyros in the world.
And this is a Greek dish.
It's a Greek dish, of course, with lamb meat and onions, cucumber sauce. And so my friend in Chesterton mails them to me every couple of months.
Huh.
He goes and he buys a couple, two or three of them, mails them out to me. They usually arrive overnight or 2 days, still perfectly good. He seals them up in little plastic bags for me. And every time I go back, which is about every 6 months, they still remember me.
Hmm.
I just go right in, or I can call in. They recognize my voice and my order.
That's one of the things that sort of interested me originally in writing about what I guess you'd call vernacular food, is that I realized that the food people talked about in their hometowns was completely different from the sort of food people would suggest to you if you went to the towns. And often their parents or relatives or something were sending them. I mean, I could see the mail sort of crisscrossed with heroes from Indiana and various other things. So I think it's one of the things that interested me. It's interesting, it's a Greek dish in Indiana. One of the first pieces I did about eating was in Cincinnati, where people believe that chili is a Cincinnati dish served by Macedonians and on spaghetti and ordered by a code, like give me a three-way, give me a six-way. And I think they pretty much have to leave Cincinnati to find out that people in other parts of the country, like the Southwest, eat something called chili. It's sort of the way somebody in Nevada has to be drafted and sent out to boot camp before he realizes that not all filling stations have slot machines.
Well, I've been to many Greek restaurants where you sit down and order a gyro and it comes, you know, open face or different styles. But to me, there's nothing like one from a little mom-and-pop roadside stand operation that's just filled to the brim with all kinds of good stuff and, you know, more than you could possibly eat in one sitting.
Is that a guiding principle, do you think, Calvin, that you should never order something that should be hand food that's served on a plate?
Plates have always made me suspicious of certain kind of food. Barbecue, for instance. I have had good barbecue on a plate. I try not to be completely narrow and rigid on authenticity. There was a time many years ago that I was eating a cup of gazpacho at a street fair in the West Village, and I was enumerating in my mind how it differed from the truly authentic gazpacho of, say, Seville. And then I realized that one of the ways that it differed was that it tasted better. So I think I try not to be too much of a purist. And in barbecue, for instance, I'm not one of the people who's really concerned about whether the barbecue proprietor chops up his own wood. It's okay with me if he uses other people's woods.
Mick, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, Neil.
And send us an order when you, next time you're calling back home.
Hey, if you guys ever get to Chesterton, Indiana, get to George's Euro spot. It's the best place in town.
Okay, thanks very much again.
That sounded like a no on the order there,
It did,
Neil.
Yeah. It sounded like he's going to keep it all for himself.
Right.
Yes. Let's go now to Sandra, who joins us on the line from Oakland, California.
Hi. Yeah, I was fortunate enough in the 80s to be part of an organization that shipped Armenian kids from the United States to Soviet Armenia to spend a summer at, I guess, our version of the Vatican in Puragan. And one of the things that was sort of a daily deal for us was that we would eat at the monastery, which was pretty much as lousy food as you could possibly hope to see. And we noticed that the kids would start pushing their food around, and then one by one they'd start going across the street to go mail letters home at the farmer's market. And I was probably one of the fourth or fifth people to figure out that something was going on, so I tagged along. And apparently there was this big, huge farmer's market, all kinds of stalls of vegetables and fruits and herbs. And in the back of this farmer's market was this metal shack that, the best way I can describe it was raised up about 6, maybe 5 feet off the ground. It was a house. Somebody was actually living in it. And so the front part of the house had a metal floor to it. And they would stoke a fire underneath. I was seeing people like they were sticking logs and coals and things underneath the house. And when you came up and you sat down on these little makeshift bar stools, they would take this round, it almost looked like a street cover, and pull it off the floor, and there were these sheeshes that were stuck on this cover, and they would flip it over, and they would just grab fresh lamb meat and jab it onto these sheeshes and then turn it back down and stick it back into the floor of the house. And 5 minutes later, we had the most incredible shish kebab. My mouth is watering thinking about it now. I've never
yours isn't the only one.
It was fabulous lamb shish kebab, and it was just fresh lamb that I guess they had from the butcher at the farmer's market, and they marinated it all morning, and then when you came up to eat, they just cooked it right there on the floor.
Well, Sandra, thank you very much for calling to share that with us.
I'm
now remembering some of that lamb that I had in the mountains of Kurdistan that belies my reputation for always going to the worst place to eat, but that was the only place in town. It was fabulous, though.
You couldn't beat the flavor, and I don't know if it was because it was so fresh or if it was just because the food that we were given during the rest of the day was so bad, but this was fabulous stuff.
Thanks again. We're going to be talking more with Calvin Trillin after a short break and taking more of your calls. We're talking about the search for great cuisine wherever you may find it, out of a food cart or a hot dog stand. Give us your phone calls, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with writer and eater Calvin Trillin. You can read about his adventures in finding some of the great food anywhere on the planet in his new book, Feeding Again, Savoring Local Specialties from Kansas City to Cusco. So what kind of food is your town known for? Our email address is totn@npr.org, or you can give us a call and tell us about your favorite dish. The phone number again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address again, totn@npr.org. And that description that we just heard just before the break, Calvin, about the lamb in Armenia, sometimes you just find some of the most amazing things in some of the most out-of-the-way places on Earth.
Yeah, I think that's true. And often the people don't even realize, you know, they think that's what whatever it is tastes like, and they don't make a big thing about it. I was wondering during that description about people who live in the house walking across there, you know, getting up in the middle of the night in their bare feet or something. It sounds kind of dangerous to me. Maybe the public health department in that part of Soviet Armenia wasn't right on the ball.
You do sometimes wonder, you know, what would happen if the U.S. Department of Agriculture ever showed up to inspect any of these places. But
well, it's true. They actually outlawed a certain kind of country ham that was, I don't mean a kind of a country ham, but sort of individual proprietor's country ham because of the OSHA laws and various things. And a lot of, so there really became what I've always referred to as bootleg country hams that were illegal. I can imagine people being chased by their revenuers as they got away with their illegal hams, but they still tasted good.
Let's go.
A country ham really, it should have little bits. It's not only very ugly from the aging, but also, I think for true authenticity, should have little bits of the county weekly sticking to it.
Let's go now to Brad, who reads his county weekly in Boise, Idaho.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Oh, yeah. When Mr. Trillin mentioned New Iberia, it made me think of my time down in Pascagoula, Mississippi, where I'd get to go to Bozo's Fish Market and have a wonderful crawfish poor boy.
And what was the best part of it?
Well, I guess it was all the experience. You'd be going in this fish market, and it wouldn't make you hungry smelling all the fish there, but you'd wander in back to where the kitchen was, and the head of the family would be back there and his lazy boy all kicked up, and he'd ask you what you wanted, and he'd write it on a brown bag for you and hand it to you, and you'd have to go and hand it to the people behind the counter, and away they'd go on making your favorite poor boy, all dressed up, sloppy.
Calvin, you want to be careful about, advertising. And on the other hand, you know, someplace called Bozo's, you'd have to sort of lean toward a place like that.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, there used to be a Bozo's in New Orleans. I don't know if it had any connection. There's also a wonderful place for that in New Orleans called Uglich's. A lot of the fish, particularly the shellfish in that part of Louisiana, is controlled by Yugoslavs down in Plaquemines Parish and places like that. So a lot of the markets and the places have names like Uglich's.
Brad, thanks very much.
Great. Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go now to Colby, who's with us from Cleveland.
Yes. Excuse me.
That's all right.
I just have a couple of regional specialties that I thought I'd throw out. One is a product called Geta that is available in the Cincinnati-Covington, Kentucky area.
I just had some 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
And it's what people from Pennsylvania would call scrapple.
Well, yes. The difference is that scrapple is made with cornmeal and pork scraps. The Geta is made with pin oats instead of the cornmeal.
I didn't know that distinction, but they both taste good.
Yes, they do. It's a German specialty, but that's one of the things I pick up in my business travels. Today, the other item is I'm on my way back. I'm in Cleveland now, having just come back from Chicago and Racine, Wisconsin. And there is a, I guess you could call it a Danish type pastry.
A Kringle, Racine Kringle.
That's the one. That's the one. I'm not allowed to come back from Racine without one.
Yeah, those are good. And the Chicago specialty is something called called Italian beef, which is marinated. If you want to make your own, you can get it to go and get the bread separately. And if you do that, you buy it by the quart. I think it's the only place I've ever heard of where beef comes by the quart.
Hey, Colby?
That's what I'll have to look for, yes.
For those of us who think of the word Kringle only after the word Chris, what is a Kringle?
It's like a ring-shaped Danish pastry. And it's pretty much like a Danish pastry. It just happens to be a particularly rich, and it's everybody in the near Racine, Wisconsin knows about it. I don't know if it's made by more than the one bakery that I know of. Am I allowed to mention their name?
And you'll notice that the Racine people are a bit tubby.
Maybe that's why. That and the beer.
From the description, I was wondering if it was one of those foods that, as you're eating it, you can feel your arteries hardening.
Probably. I think it must have real butter and lots of cheese in it, maybe even a little lard.
Okay, Colby. Thanks very much, and probably a good idea to get out and take a walk today.
Yes, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go now to Elaine, who's with us from Mountain View, California.
Hi.
Hi, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi. Calvin Trillin.
Yes.
You're absolutely one of my favorite writers in the whole world.
Thank you.
When my New Yorker comes, I run my finger down the index. If you and Joe Klein aren't there, I don't know. I get a little dejected. But anyway, you wrote...
I'll tell that to the other writers.
No. Don't tell them.
Okay.
You said once in one of your articles, never eat anything undelicious. And it's a part of my belief system now. And I just wanted to thank you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. On the other hand, I balance that with Miss Piggy's advice on nutrition. I look to Miss Piggy for advice on nutrition and in many other areas of life. And Miss Piggy once said, "Never eat more than you can lift."
I think
that's good.
I'll add that to my credo.
I'd always heard a variation on that, which was never try to eat anything bigger than your head.
Yeah, that's. I've heard that, too.
Okay. Thanks very much, Elaine.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Jenny, and Jenny's with us from Homerville, Georgia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to see if Mr. Calvin had ever had fried gator tail, because that's our delicacy where I live.
I once went to the... Catfish Festival, the St. John's River Catfish Festival near Palatka, Florida. I think it was Crescent City, Florida, but it was the nearest big town was Palatka.
Uh-huh.
And they had there in some of those restaurants what they called a swamp critter special, which was frog's legs, cooter, which is their name or maybe your name also for turtle, and gator. I went to a place where they process the gator, and the guy said they just take the tail, and he said, and then they take that loin muscle out, and I said, well, that makes me feel a lot better about eating it. Said, no, that's the part we eat. I had no idea of that, but it's not bad. The other animal like that that I talk about eating in the book is nutria in Louisiana. Nutria is a rather unattractive animal. It's actually a koi poo originally from South America, and unfortunately, alligators don't eat enough of them, so they've sort of proliferated in Louisiana. And Louisiana had at one point a scheme to eat its way out of the nutria crisis, because the nutria were eating up all the marsh grass. So there was a hope of getting people interested in eating nutria. I don't know how that went, but I did notice when I went back in the kitchen, somebody showed me preparation of a nutria. It's one of the few animals I've ever seen that actually looked better as a carcass than as an animal. It was lacking that rat-like tail and those huge orange teeth. I think orange teeth really don't add to the attractiveness of any animal.
Best left on pumpkins, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, if you're ever our way, you stop through Hummerville, we're the edge of the Okefenokee Swamp, and have some gator tail.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jenny.
Thank you. I appreciate your show.
Speaking of weird food, we got an email from Helen Ogden. Perhaps the strangest regional food I ever tasted was on a hill trek in Thailand when our guide invited us to try fried elephant dung beetles. He collected them from the fresh dung of our elephants and fried them over an open fire. I was the only person in the group who would sample the dish. I actually ate two of them just to prove to myself that I could. They are crunchy and taste like hay. You do have to remove their legs so they don't get stuck between your teeth.
Yeah, I always remove the legs of a dung beetle before eating it. It's just really courtesy where I come from. It's not even have to do with teeth. You don't eat the legs. That is an odd thing. Of course, in Chinatown, even in New York Chinatown, there's a lot of that sort of stuff to eat. It's quite common now to find duck tongue in Chinatown. Of course, it takes a whole mess of duck tongues to make a dish. There's not a whole lot of meat on a duck tongue. And a restaurant that actually delivers to my house, I mean, we're in the delivery area, has something called fish tripe with pork sinew. I've never had it, but I have to say that I like the thought of living in a city where you can get fish tripe with pork sinew delivered to the door if you want it. It's just sort of comforting to know that it's out there, but I haven't had any.
Let's go now to Mark, who's with us from San Diego.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was just calling because, well, first of all, a couple of comments. I was born and raised in northern Brazil in a city in the middle of the Amazon, so to speak. And I was wondering if our guest has ever been to northern Brazil, and if not, when he does go, I'll suggest two things that, although I haven't been back there in a while, I still remember, and I can't wait to go back. The first one is a very typical Indian, native Brazilian, let's say, influenced dish called pato de tucupi, which is a duck made in the tucupi sauce, which is extracted from manioc, and served with white rice and some sort of vegetable called jambu. It's absolutely delicious, and it's very socially interesting because it cuts across every social class, and it's served in very fancy tables and very simple households, and it's absolutely delicious. The second one is my all-time favorite snack called tapioquinha, which is a very simple snack made of manioc flour. It's just all they do is just get that stuff and then put it in a frying pan, and it kind of sort of melts and gets, just it becomes sort of a pancake, and then you just put all kinds of things on it. They serve it with just butter or coconut or sometimes condensed milk. So it can be like a sweet or salty snack, and it's delicious, and you can get in every street fair or farmer's market. There are specialized places where you can get them. My favorite places are these farmer's markets in this island just across the river, the island of Mosquera, where they have all the ladies making them in the streets, and it's in downtown in a little village they have there. So if you ever go there, try that. It's absolutely delicious.
Calvin, have you gotten to northern Brazil?
No, I've been to Brazil, but I've never been to that part of Brazil. But there's a restaurant about 200 yards from where I live in New York whose subtitle is Regional Cooking of Brazil. So I took notes. I'm going to go in there and demand those dishes.
Is that, we'll see what happens. 46th Street or somewhere around?
No, it's in the village on Bedford Street.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's a lovely little restaurant. Casa, yeah. Casa, it's called.
What is it called?
Casa.
Something like house, I think it translates.
Yeah, house in Portuguese as well. Well, I don't know if they're going to have that, but I hope they do, and I'm very picky about that because I grew up there and I've known the best places to eat them, so it's kind of hard to get it out of there, but hopefully they'll have it. It's from northern Brazil, and usually they have, in American Brazilian restaurants, they have a lot of the southern, you know, southeastern Brazilian cuisine, which is like the beans and the rice and the...
Okay, Mark. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're speaking with Calvin Trillin about his new book, Feeding a Yen, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we got from Gene in Cave Creek, Arizona. Has Calvin tried the Transcendental Frito Pie? It's a staple of the Native Americans in New Mexico, a good spicy chili and cheese poured right into a bag of Frito chips. Yum, sounds awful, but tastes great, especially if eaten while sitting under a mesquite tree. I had it last in July at the Seven Northern Tribes Indian Market north of Santa Fe. Fabulous.
It's funny. Frito Pie is actually mentioned in the book because... of a local restaurant I wrote about, which had it on the menu because somebody from Texas loved it and missed it and lived down the block. And I thought of it, I'm sure it's true that it's also a Native American dish, but I thought of it as sort of a Friday night football snack bar specialty in Texas. I've had discussions. I think it's fair to call them scholarly discussions about Frito Pie, about whether or not it's authentic if the Frito bag isn't cut on the side rather than on the front. I mean, the side is the right way to cut it. And somebody told me that they thought that the absolute authentic version has a canned chili in it from those little cans you used to plug in. You know, it used to have a kind of a warm-up place in diners. But it's funny how picky people are about that. I've had people from Arkansas tell me that the great specialty of Arkansas, Coke with goobers in it, that is peanuts. Goobers are, I think, originally an African word for peanut. It's only absolutely authentic if you have Tom's salted peanuts in the Coke. And some of the Arkansas people were quite disappointed when finally there was a president from Arkansas that people in Georgetown cocktail parties didn't start drinking Coke with goobers, or at least white wine with goobers.
Well, we may have another chance. You never know. Calvin,
that's true.
Calvin Trillin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil. It's nice to be here.
Okay. Calvin Trillin's new book is Feeding a Yen, Savoring Local Specialties from Kansas City to Cuzco. And he was with us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from our break, we're going to be talking about the biggest military operation in Iraq since the fall of Saddam and what looks like might be a guerrilla war, which is beginning to develop in the north and west of Baghdad. And we're also going to be going to Presque Isle, Maine, at the end of U.S. Highway 1, where they're setting up an absolute scale model of the solar system. Bet you didn't know the solar system was centered in Presque Isle, Maine. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.